right. Well, welcome to Skype a Scientist Live. We're so lucky to have you here today. Everybody else, thanks for joining us. Let's start it off with some housekeeping. Next week, we've got a full schedule, just like we have all month. On Monday, we're going to be with Sarah Shorno. We're going to be talking about hagfish slime, which I am so pumped about because I love slimy animals. And then on Tuesday, we're going to be talking about vocal learning and genetics in parrots. And then on Friday, we're going to be talking about disaster drones with a scientist named Laura Hart. So that is going to be like pretty cool, and I'm very excited about it. The following week is going to be cephalopod week, and we're going to be talking about squid senses, how to raise a squid in captivity, and cuttlefish. And then we're just putting together the schedule now for July, August, and September. And you can check out who we have coming up in those months on our website under the live stream tab. Next week on Thursday at 8 p.m. for adults, we have our trivia night, and that's going to be with a microbiologist from Philadelphia named Justin, and it's going to be good. Justin Stewart. It's going to be a good time. That's all the housekeeping I really have. I hope you all have been having a good week. We have been giving you a bunch of different things to check out, to read, to listen to, et cetera, over the last 2 weeks. And I think today my recommendation is going to be a podcast done by the New York Times called the 1619 Project. It's basically like a history of the last 400 years told through the eyes of Black people in our country. And it may not be great for the little ones, but for any parents that are hanging out or like teens that are here and above, check it out. It's really well told and also interesting and just good stuff to know if you're an American or any other human. That's all of the housekeeping I have. So Riley, do you want to introduce yourself, say who you are, what you do, and why you like it?
Sure. So my name is Riley Black. I'm a professional science writer and amateur paleontologist. I mostly write about dead stuff with big scary teeth and whatever else catches my attention. I've blogged over the years for National Geographic, Wired, Smithsonian. I've had bylines and publications from Slate to Nature and Science. And I just, I got the dinosaur bug at about five at the latest and just kept going with it. Like after that first visit to the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, seeing that big brontosaurus skeleton. So one of those ones with the little head, the long neck, big body, long tail. I had to know more, and just starting to ask those questions just led me to this career. I actually dropped out of college 2 credits short of my degree. So the career that I have is just entirely based upon reading, asking questions, wanting to share it, and kind of found this alternate route back to paleontology.
That's amazing. So you've written books, you've had a column in Scientific American, and then you've also done a bunch of like freelance stuff as well. So at what point in your career did you start writing for the public like this?
Yeah, so it really came about when I was in college. So I went to Rutgers University in New Jersey. And I started off as a marine science major because I wanted to study sharks, and I was dead set on it. And like, Riley, you're going to study like plankton chemistry. I'm like, but I'm bad at math, though. And so that it didn't really work out. And I shifted into ecology, and that also wasn't quite working because I know like in our fields, we often kind of make fun of, the person who comes in and says, I want to study Tyrannosaurus, or I want to study dolphins, or whatever it was. I kind of was that kid, but I would not be deterred. I didn't want to learn forestry calculus. I wanted to learn, like, why do cheetahs go that fast? Were the kind of questions I wanted to know. So I took, just by chance, a course on the history of life through time, and another course, a seminar on African prehistory, so focusing on like very early humans and their paleontological and archaeological record. And those professors like, you need to switch majors. You need to be in this. That wasn't possible for me. Uh-huh. As I learned more, that was like the spark that really rekindled this. And as I was reading papers, I started blogging about them, started writing about them. And I just got really bit by that bug. And it began on a website, I don't think it's around anymore, called Think Progress, that was giving out scholarships for blogging. But even after that ended, I was like, I need to do this. So I set up a WordPress blog and went over to scienceblogs.com after that, which was like the big deal back in those days. I feel so old now even talking about, everybody wanted to be Pharyngula was the big one. Right. But that really opened up that career. So, you know, I was going to school, I was working full time, I was reading and blogging sort of part time. But as I did it, one thing led to another. Blogging led to the occasional op-ed, which led to my first book, which I published in 2010, called Written in Stone. And in about 2011, I moved out to Salt Lake City in Utah and went full time, and just haven't looked back since.
Amazing. I really like hearing from people who have these careers that are like not just like climbing up a ladder that's preset. I'm another person like that, where I'm running a nonprofit that I started myself, that I started doing like in my spare time while I was in school, and then just kind of like jumped and hoped my parachute would come out, you know, in the process. And so I think it's good to hear from people who are kind of carving their own path and just like following what they love and who are successful at doing it. And you for sure are just killing the game, which is great.
Awesome. Thank you. I'm trying. When you said parachute, it made me think like, yeah, freelancing is kind of like if you're falling down a bottomless pit, but you have a parachute, but you need to keep checking it like every month. Like, okay, it's still okay. That's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, no, totally. I understand that completely. Cool. So how many books at this point have you written?
So I've written, oh my God, this is like tattoos where I have to take like a second and count. Three for adults. So there's Written in Stone, which was about the sort of history of vertebrate paleontology, like how some major transitions, like the origin of elephants and birds and the first creatures to walk on land, really like informed what our view of evolution is and how it works. Second one was My Beloved Brontosaurus. It's like, ta-da, here we go.
Very good.
And that one's about like why dinosaurs keep changing. Like, even though it's a dinosaur book, it involves a lot of science. It's mostly about the process of science. Like, okay, we have the bones, they've always existed. Why does our vision of these animals keep changing? And basically the interrelationship between fact and theory is really what it's about, using Brontosaurus as an example. And then the third one, the latest one, is Skeleton Keys. And that one, it's all about our skeletons. So sort of the natural and unnatural history of our bones, our skeletons. So not only the evolutionary history and the biology of our bones, but how our skeletons have influenced ideas of who we are and how we connect to each other, or don't connect to each other, for that matter.
Right.
For children, I wrote a book called Prehistoric Predators, which is all about just carnivores through time. And I have another one coming out called Did You See That Dinosaur? Hopefully within the next year, which is a search and find book. Cool. And I'm working on another book for adults with St. Martin's Press right now. The tentative title is Crossing Hell Creek, but it's all about if you were to stand in Montana 66 million years ago when that asteroid struck, what would you see transpire over the next hour, day, week, month, year, million years, like watching that ecosystem be broken down and then come back to life again. So, you know, books are, they take a long time, but they're definitely my favorite to do.
That's awesome. So when you kind of decide, like, this is the thing I'm going to have my next book about, and then you dive into the literature and all of this stuff, like, how do you decide, like a scientific paper has so many details in it. How do you pick out the details that you're like, everybody needs to know about that, but this detail is like TMI? Like, how do you parse that?
I think a lot of it is a matter of narrative as a writer. So what is the story I'm trying to tell and what supports that story? Not in a matter of cherry picking and ignoring things that might be contradictory or this is complicated. In a lot of my writing, I feel like I've tried to, if something's complicated or we don't quite know the answer, making that clear, because I think that's important. Because I think the view of science is often too much like, it reminds me of one of those early seasons of Futurama, where the giant brains, they're collecting all the information in the universe, just kind of sticking facts like into their data repository. I think a lot of people think that's what science is. It's like, okay, we learned a fact, goes on shelf now, on to the next thing, right? And that's not how it works at all. So a lot of the stuff I try, the things that lead me to particular stories are kind of like those oh wow moments, like I didn't know that, or just like that's really cool. Like I think the day like this past year when that study came out about cuttlefish wearing 3D glasses, and so these depth perception, like I was telling everybody I knew whether I wanted to hear it or not about this study, because even just the picture, it's like, look at this,
it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous. Yeah, that study everybody needs to know about. And so if you didn't see it, look up cuttlefish 3D glasses. It literally is a cuttlefish with like glasses stuck to its face. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it looks like it's ready to watch like Creature from the Black Lagoon or something like that.
For sure. I would watch the Creature from the Black Lagoon with a cuttlefish any day of the week. Just sign me up. That sounds great.
Yeah, and it just did get back to what you said about detail and what you pick. Like, that's a good point, because sometimes when I read through a paper, the point that I want to make or what I think is interesting or exciting is not necessarily what the main conclusion of the paper is about. Because, like, if you haven't read a scientific paper, for those of you who have, like, you know that there's always, like, a background section. It's like, this is why we're asking this question, and this is the historical value of it. And sometimes the information in the background surprises me more than the main point of the paper, especially if it's a description of something like a new species where you have to really justify that. So the taxonomic and the systematic description, all those little details that make it something new, may or may not be interesting, but sometimes like, okay, this is why this is significant, this is how it fits in this family, and we used to think it was something different. An example of that would be, there's a dinosaur called Troodon, right? So wounding tooth, this little like raptor-like dinosaur that we've known about for a while, but was named from a little sharp tooth, and that was it. Because, I mean, that's where, like, the name, like, that suffix don comes from. It means tooth. So, like, somebody named a dinosaur from a little tooth. But we don't really know what that tooth belonged to. And as we find other, depending on who you ask, Troodon either existed for millions of years from Alaska through Utah, or there's a bunch of different species through time, and we just don't have stuff to compare it to. So sometimes if it's a new species description, it's not like the most mind-blowing thing in the world, but hearing the background, like, why are we having this debate? That's the interesting stuff that I pull out.
That's super cool. I always think, yeah, that the introduction of papers are my favorite part, because you get to see like the motivation behind why the scientist is doing it and this like broader picture. Because a lot of times, like, reading scientific papers is fine, but like the specific thing that they're learning is just like one little like closer to us getting it, and then seeing the full context is so much more interesting, in my opinion. So a question from Gavin Myers. Gavin wants to know, so why paleontology books? Like, what is it about paleontology that you think it just like draws you to want to spend, you know, a year writing about?
I think part of it's just that's the science that first attracted me when I was young, and I've just stuck with it. There's just so much to know. To me, like, when I look at any kind of prehistoric skeleton or fossil, like, all these questions come to mind of like, okay, like, even something like a track or a footprint. It's like, what made that track? How fast was it moving? Where was it going? Was it moving with other animals? What was the environment like? All these questions that we don't necessarily have answers to all of them. But I think a lot of it is the mystery of it. And, you know, especially now when the world feels like much smaller and we're interconnected much more and we've mapped so much of the planet, not to say that we know everything that's in there, but that idea of like the past as a foreign country kind of thing, that the past has these layers that you can, literal layers that you can go through and see how the world was different. So there are entire lost worlds to explore and all these gaps that we still have. And part of it, that it's such a vibrant science right now, like, even in terms of naming animals, a new dinosaur species is named on the average every 2 weeks. And that's just dinosaurs. That's not counting fossil mammals or trilobites or, you know, corals or any of the other things that are important to understanding of the past. But we haven't even found everything that there is to sort of categorize and understand yet, much less analyze the biology of it, the ecology of it, how it contributes to its evolution. So I love that you're kind of looking into this, like, this big chasm of the scientific unknown, and you can explore just about anything that you want.
That's so cool. So, like, what is different between how we looked at fossils 100 years ago and how we look at them now? Like, how is, like, a lot of times we think of paleontology as just like, here was a rock, I look at the rock. But I know it's a lot more than that with the technology that we have. So how does that all work?
Yeah, I mean, modern tech has really made paleontology a very different science. And museum building and sort of the history of the field has a lot to do with it in terms of, if you look at the 19th century, you had the famous bone wars between those paleontologists, O.C. Marsh and E.D. Cope on the East Coast. And they were mostly trying to establish the science in America because they had to go do their schooling in Germany and in Europe. There wasn't really any paleontology program in the U.S. You had naturalists who sometimes described fossils, but that was about it. But that was like this war of two egos, these two cantankerous men who are just trying to name as many things as possible.
Right.
Following from that, the people that they trained started this era of museum building. This is when you get like the AM&H and the Field and the Carnegie and all those institutions that are all trying to get like, just sending crews out to be, get me the biggest dinosaur that you can. And we wanted the public. But scientifically, they didn't think it was very important. So paleontology was very much like, let's go find stuff, let's dig it up, maybe understand something about the evolutionary interconnections. But a lot of it was kind of, there's a lot of ego and a lot of pride and a lot of showpieces. And then with dinosaurs in particular, not all of paleontology, but dinosaurs in particular, it was that renaissance of the 1970s where we started to appreciate them as animals. Like, so was their physiology like, was their biology like, along with sort of the access to more computing, so you can like do things like morphometric analysis, take a skull and put a whole bunch of pinpoints around it to other ones, see, okay, to get from this step to this step, what sort of axes do you change? What shapes do you change? Now, things like geochemical analysis to analyze where are they getting their drinking water from. We have micro CT scanning to look inside the bones and look at the bone histology and come up with an idea of how old the dinosaurs are. A lot of the field work part is more or less the same, but the analysis, we have so many more tools now to ask some of these biological questions. So it's not a matter of this great age of digging up extinct monsters, you know, bring them back petrified, as one book was called, but really like from any skeleton that you have, we now can really go into the bone, sometimes literally, draw out aspects of this animal's life.
That's wild. So kind of related to what you were just saying, Arjun wants to know, how do we know the age of fossils?
Okay, so there are two answers to that. There's the sort of geologic age, like how many millions year old. Uh-huh. And that has to do with, you see, isotopes that break down at a particular rate. So if we know that a certain radioactive mineral breaks down at a certain rate, we know its half-life, we can use that in rocks that have some of those minerals in them. So like an ash deposit from a volcano will have radioactive minerals in it. And then we can use that ash layer to get a date. We usually can't date dinosaur fossils directly unless they're buried in an ash bed. Mm-hmm. But you know, the key part, because you know, carbon dating doesn't go far enough. That'll work for some ice age fossils, but not for Mesozoic animals, not things like T-Rex or Triceratops. In terms of how old an individual dinosaur was, oftentimes we can cut, if we have the long bones, if we have like the leg bones, like a thigh bone, a femur, we can cut into that and there'll be rings, just like tree rings. And we can count those, and those usually coincide with shifts between like a wet season where there's a lot of food and a dry season where there isn't very much and the dinosaurs are quickly. This doesn't always work. We have some big dinosaurs that don't have any rings inside their legs, and we're like, okay, well, this is not a one-year-old. It's impossible to go from an egg to something 40 feet long in 1 year. But when we have some of those rings, depending on what that ancient environment was like, we can get an idea of how old that individual dinosaur was. So for example, like Sue the T-Rex is also not only the largest and most complete T-Rex that we know of, but also the oldest individual T-Rex that we know of, about 38 years old.
Cool. That's awesome. The next question is, what's the weirdest dinosaur fossil you've ever personally found? Or we can also open it up to just like seeing in a museum.
Geez, the weirdest dinosaur. So a number of, I'll tie this back into our theme of science writing. A couple of years ago, I was at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting in Los Angeles. I think that was the one, if I remember correctly. It's either Los Angeles or Dallas. But in any case, I was at a Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting, and this is like the big annual meeting for anybody who works on any fossil vertebrate, whether it's fish, mammals, dinosaurs, the whole thing. And in one of the dinosaur sessions, there was an update about an animal called Deinochirus. And you might have seen this animal in children's books about dinosaurs and some museum displays, just this huge set of like 6 foot long arms. And that's all we knew, the claws, the complete arms and the shoulder blades, but that was it. The rest of the animal was a mystery. We had an idea that it belonged to a group of dinosaurs called ornithomimids, like ostrich mimics. So if you imagine like an ostrich with a long tail that, and you know, arms with large claws on them, that's more or less what these animals look like. Well, after all these decades, the rest of Deinochirus was filled in, and it had this kind of like beaky, almost like duck-billed head, and a sail on its back, and this kind of clump on the end of its tail that suggests there are feathers attached to it. So if you imagine an animal the size of a T-Rex with the basic chassis of an ostrich, covered in feathers, this duckbill type head and a sail on its back. And the paleontologist who presented this actually had an animation of this animal, like a 3D render of it walking. And just like the whole room, you could hear everybody like hold their breath. Because many of us, like we're all, even though we're professionals, we're still dino nerds. And we've all known about this animal since we were kids. So to see it like mystery finally solved and it'd be totally like left field of what we were guessing.
Right.
Amazing.
That's awesome. How exciting. That's great. Having, so like those moments in conferences where the whole room like goes quiet and gasps. I've been to many like conferences in my like 10-year career as a scientist, but I've only really seen it once. And it was when the scientist from Japan was showing us this cuttlefish mating thing it was doing. And basically the cuttlefish was like putting its arms out and then it looked like flash bulbs. Like it would be like bam, 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 bam with like white and black. And everybody in the audience just like gasped and made, and it's like one of the best parts I think of being a scientist also is like everybody getting so jazzed. Cause at conferences, we kind of try to like keep our cool, you know, like we're like, oh yes, I'll show you about the cool science I'm doing today. But when we all just like geek out as a crew, it's like, it gives you chills. I don't know. That's a really wonderful thing to have experienced. We have lots of other questions here. Okay. So how do you balance, this is from Ashley, how do you balance engaging your audience with making sure that you get across like the facts?
Yeah. I mean, part of that is just a dedication to accuracy. But there is a balancing act between getting everything in that I want to without making it a scientific paper in and of itself, because we already have the paper. Yeah. And I know at times, like we were talking before about pulling one part of the story out and the rest of it, and that some researchers might feel like, well, wait, you didn't talk about all those other things. It's like, I know that I didn't, but then I'd also be writing a book. So some of it's just a, like part of the trade that you pick a story and you build that narrative. But part of it is going like, if we don't know something, pointing that out, or if something is contentious or questioned, or if there is a debate, but I don't feel it's necessarily a reasonable debate. Because there are some papers that come out where, you know, as science literate folks, we just like shake our heads. Like, for example, there's one from years and years ago called Megatherium the Stabber about giant ground sloths, which we know herbivores from various lines of evidence. But the idea was that a giant, like an elephant-sized sloth, was roaming around the Ice Age world, flipping over giant armadillos and things and using its claws to basically rip them open. And it's more carnivorous than we thought. It's not, you know, it's a fine hypothesis, but there's not a lot to back it up.
Right.
In that case, like, in some ways, like, I try not to be so objective that I just, like, well, I'm just going to report what the scientists say.
Right.
Matter of interpretation of saying, like, okay, is there something up with this? Is there a reasonable debate about it? What do I include? If I feel something's relatively solid, it's easy to write about. But if it's contentious, that's where a lot of that comes into play.
Right. So do you get a lot of pushback from scientists that are like, I can't believe you left out this essential thing that I worked on? Like, is that a thing that happens to you?
Every now and then, the biggest example of that was a paper about how our faces and our hands evolved for punching, that basically like violence formed this critical aspect of like the formation of the human face and the human hand. Trying to say that like combat amongst Australopithecines, so like Paranthropus, so this, what you might have heard as Nutcracker Man, so this early human with these big cheekbones, big deep jaw, big teeth, that was a face that basically evolved for combat between the males in a social group, and that over time our hands became better and better at making a fist. That doesn't track with the fossil, like the whole argument doesn't make sense in and of itself.
Right.
So I heard about it and I was a little bit cheeky with it, and I did call it bro science, and the researcher was not very happy with that characterization at all. But I stood by it because it felt very much like guys saying like, yeah, being tough and punching each other is what
makes fall for it.
Yeah. Right. And it's like, no, that's a hypothesis.
Right.
But you kind of undercut your own argument. And I felt that was important to say.
Yeah. Good. So yeah, that's a wild hypothesis, but I mean, it could be true, but also let's go with things that we actually have evidence for, probably. Right
Yeah. Oh yeah, we could talk for hours, I'm sure, about the difference between what we think about prehistoric people and what the actual evidence is.
Right Oh man. So we've got a question here. How deep down can you find fossils? I'm guessing like in the earth.
Mm-hmm. Right. So we have, you know, life has been on this planet for about 3.5 billion years. So, but the thing is with geology is like, it's not just kind of this continuous rind that's made around the planet. It just stacks up over time. Some environments don't get preserved at all. Other ones like are probably, you know, deep in the earth's crust that we don't have access to. Mm-hmm. So usually when we go looking for fossils, we're not actually digging. We're not digging down. We look on a map to see where the right time period and the right sort of rock is exposed that we're likely to find fossils. So the basic fossils need to be already coming out at the surface for us to find them. Things like ground penetrating radar don't work. And just digging, you know, like sort of, like if you remember Jurassic Park and the little informational video when they go in the visitor center and it shows the miners kind of doing a dig dug thing all the way down. We don't do that. Also, if you watch that cartoon, there's no ladder. They can't get back out. That part always bothers me. Okay. Yeah, usually fossils, they need to be in strata that have been environments where sediment is being laid down. Uh-huh. They get compressed and, you know, sometimes subsumed over time, but then tectonic activity brings them back up to the surface. So when we're looking for like dinosaur fossils, we usually look for like shards of bone, what we call float. Like these bones are already starting to erode out of the hill. We follow in like breadcrumbs and hopefully there's like a nice big leg sticking out or something that tells us there's something more. And that's when we dig.
Awesome. That's cool. So like, let's say there's like a quarry being dug, for example, mm-hmm. like, can you see the strata as that's happening? Or is that just like the wrong kind of rock? Or like, is that one of like a man-made opportunity for fossil finding?
Yeah, so sometimes you can see the strata. It depends on how thick layers are because they're not the uniform in thickness. So some will be meters thick and the fossil will be somewhere in between or at the top or the bottom. Other times you can see that, like for example, in a floodplain type environment, you can see the layers where, okay, it was a lake at this time and then it dried out and then it was a stream bed and then it was a lake again. And going, so, you know, going through the layers in that sense. Usually a formation, for example, one of my favorites is the Morrison Formation of Western North America. So that's where you get like Allosaurus, Stegosaurus, Brontosaurus, all those classic dinosaurs. Uh-huh. It has separate what we call members, and it has at least three members that are different time periods. It spans about 10 million years, and it's in different thicknesses in different places.
Cool.
So all that stuff is like so variable, and that's why it's so important when we find fossils, or especially when you know, someone like an amateur paleontologist or someone just walking around finds fossils, which happens all the time, that we know where that fossil is from, that we take good field notes, that we know something about the rocks it was laid down in, because that's all the context for what kind of environment it was and what kind of happened to this particular organism.
Cool. That's awesome. The next question is from Dexter, age 8, and Milo, age 9. One of the hobbies we love is bird watching. We've heard people say that birds are modern dinosaurs, but we don't really understand what that means. Could you help explain what that's all about?
Absolutely, yeah. So birds are most certainly living dinosaurs. So the same way that all of us here are mammals, birds are just another kind of dinosaur. So if we think about it in evolutionary terms, way back in the Jurassic, about 150 million years ago, the very first birds evolved from raptor-like dinosaurs. There was some, if you think of something like Velociraptor, but relatively tiny and covered in feathers, that's more or less what the first birds looked like. And for millions of years, they were just another kind of dinosaur. But when the extinction happened at the end of the Cretaceous period, that's when all what we call the non-avian dinosaurs, so all the dinosaurs like Tyrannosaurus and Triceratops and stuff, and Edmontosaurus, they all disappeared. But birds were the only group to have a surviving member. And that's why we thought they were different for so long, because the whole rest of their family went extinct. But now, because of a really good fossil record, we can follow many of the steps in terms of how wings evolved, how feathers evolved, see the connection. So it's the same way that like bats are mammals as well. So birds are dinosaurs in the same way that bats are mammals, even though they look so different from the rest of them.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks. The next question is from Ashley. How do you write in a way that is as inclusive as possible?
That's something that's been on my mind a lot lately. And it's been so, especially in the last year through my transition. I think when I started, I very much had the mindset of, well, it's just about the science. I'm going to pick papers or stories that are just of interest to me and whoever did them, that's fine. You know, science is, you know, like a meritocracy. It's like whatever gets out there. I was too young and naive to understand how, who does the science and who gets supported and the sort of the leaky pipeline that we have, especially in paleontology. Many of our students and volunteers and lab prep people and field people are women or marginalized groups in science, but they're rarely promoted to curator positions or get highlighted in the media or in documentaries. And it was really, as I started to become more aware, trying to make a greater effort in, like, okay, I need a quote from somebody about pterosaurs. I could go with this person who I know will get back to me quickly and is a world expert on it, but am I just reinforcing the narrative that's like, it's the same six people doing paleontology, it's the same type of person doing paleontology, that representation and visibility matter, and that this is also a help to other people's careers, that this is something that we don't have as much diversity in the field basically being shown as there actually is. So it's not a matter of this person is senior and this is person is junior, so I'm going to talk to the senior person. It's right. Actively trying to change the field as I write, being cognizant of it. And I can always do a little bit better. But yeah, that's something that I certainly had to shift over time, thinking about, okay, who am I talking to? Why am I talking to them? Is there somebody else who might actually be able to speak to this topic just as well that I've ignored just because like they don't pop into my mind? So it's always a matter of like sort of reviewing my own biases and being aware of those and trying to work against them.
Totally. Yeah. And I think Twitter is really good for like, just kind of like plate tectonics, like unearthing these people who you may not have seen referenced in the documentary, in the science article, you know, like in like the Science Magazine article, not the primary literature. Right. And so that's really helpful for finding people for me too, for like these sessions and for all kinds of stuff. Like sometimes I just won't know, like, who's studying lizards and still a grad student if they haven't published yet, but Twitter will show me, and it's really good.
Absolutely, and it's making things a little bit more, trying to make things a little bit more even as well, because I remember Victoria Arbour, who's a great paleontologist, she's in British Columbia, mainly works on armored dinosaurs. She wrote a post a number of years ago about a documentary called Dino Gangs and how like the representation in it wasn't very good. And she made this point, like everybody is a senior researcher and they're all white men. And it seems that when you're a graduate student and you're a cisgender white man, that you know, you're treated as an expert, but nobody else, you know, in that category is. We don't see women graduate students often. We don't see, you know, people of color graduate students often in these things, underscoring just how uneven it is. So that example always sticks to my mind, like, am I representing the diversity that's actually in the field? Because it is there, but we need to amplify it.
Totally, for sure. And I feel like paleontology, I don't want to say it's worse, but it feels worse sometimes. I don't have like the data to show that, but like I was reading this book, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs, and I was maybe, I don't know, like 50 pages in, and all I had read about was like this band of boys that were going out together, and I was just like, I don't see myself in this, and I'm a cisgender white woman. So like, come on, like it's not great. Anyway, we'll get on to more science questions, but yeah, it is. I'm glad you're working hard to elevate other voices. It's really really important. Thanks. Let's see. So how does a person, like, let's say you want to become a paleontologist? Do you know how people would go about doing that?
Yeah. So there are many different routes to getting involved in paleontology. If you want to be a professor or a curator, basically like running a museum, and if you want to be Blathers from Animal Crossing and basically run the museum and know everything, my girlfriend swears I'm Blathers. Like whenever she finds a fossil, she's like, oh, I got an ichthyosaur. So like, okay, yeah, that's an ichthyosaur in its name because it's big eyes. So like, yeah, Blathers just.
Yeah, but we'll love bugs. We won't shun bugs. I'm like Blathers.
No, love for bugs, not monsters. But you can't, if you want to be something like a curator or a professor, then you more or less have to go the academic route where, you know, there's only one undergraduate paleontology program that I know of, and that's at the South Dakota School of Mines. Otherwise, you major in geology or biology, then you go to graduate school, and that's when you get to start focusing on paleontology. You'll likely have to get a PhD, likely have to do a postdoc, and then, you know, try and find a job just wherever it is and play that that game. But that's not the only route that there is. There are people, for example, who are mitigation paleontologists. So they still get their training, often through a master's degree or above. And they are hired by, for example, construction or oil companies. That if they want to drill somewhere, if they want to build somewhere, mitigation paleontologist is called to the site and does a survey, you know, checks the cores, check what's on the ground, and make sure it's not being built over something important. Or if it is, for example, the subway system in Los Angeles, they keep running through ice age deposits. So there are mitigation paleontologists excavating those things very, very quickly so that the construction can continue, but we save all those fossils. And there are people like me who are science writers and science communicators, which is another, you know, route that you can go once you've had some training. Or even just no matter what else you're doing, paleontology really requires volunteers. Like, we would not have the field that we do without hundreds, thousands of people who spend their weekends, their vacation time, you know, time every week, prepping bones in the lab, categorizing bones in our collections, going into the field and looking for fossils and digging things up. So even if it doesn't become like your career, you can still be a paleontologist and contribute to the field just by volunteering with museums and other institutions that dig up bones. Yeah.
Super cool. Awesome. The next question is, how do you know what places are going to have a lot of fossils at them?
Yeah. I wish I knew, because then I just go straight to them. I mean, sometimes if we have a quarry, then we know, okay, there's a lot of bones here. So for example, there's a place called Cleveland Lloyd Dinosaur Quarry in eastern Utah, and it's a bone bed that is chock full of this meat-eating dinosaur called Allosaurus. There are at least the remains of at least 48 individuals there, and we know that we found 48 left thigh bones, so you can only have one left thigh bone, but probably like numbers in the hundreds, probably hundreds of Allosaurus buried in this one place. They've taken cores into the hill that's behind the main quarry, and there are still bones coming out of it. Mm-hmm. So we know that this bone bed like extends for much further than has been excavated. So that would be a good place to go looking for new stuff or for, you know, better remains of animals that we already know about. Otherwise, the way that we pick fossil sites, sometimes we'll go back to a place that has yielded fossils before. Sometimes, for example, like petroleum geologists will have in their notes like, oh, I found fossils here, but they're not really interested in excavating. But if we read those notes like, oh, okay, this place looks like it might be good, and we'll go back there. Some discoveries have been made like that. Otherwise, so let's say you're a paleontologist and you want to learn more about the ancestors of T-Rex. So you want to look in the Middle Cretaceous rocks, which we don't know a whole lot about. So you get a big geological map, you look for strata that fit that time period, and you look for rock layers that are what we call sedimentary, so laid down by things like sand, mud, silt, maybe ash, things that accumulate over time. And then you just basically walk the ground and you look and you try and search for them. So there, you know, there are some quarries where we know there are a ton of bones and we can keep exploring there, but most of the exploration we do, it's just the same as was done over 100 years ago, where you just put on your backpack and you start walking.
Cool. That sounds fun. All right, then we've got about enough time for like one more audience question. Okay. And so this is one that we often get when we talk about dinosaurs. Is it possible to clone an extinct dinosaur using DNA like in Jurassic Park?
I wish that were so, I really do. So based upon what we know about DNA right now, it has a half-life, just like those radioactive minerals I was talking about before. It has a half-life, if I recall correctly, of about 520 years. So if you do the basic math that even under ideal conditions, let's say if something got buried today in a nice dry cave and got buried immediately, that DNA would only last, the last scrap of it would disappear after about 6 million years. So that's about as far back as we can go and get any genetic material. There was a paper earlier this year saying that there might be degraded remnants of DNA in some Mesozoic dinosaur bones, but we can't get that. And I know there's been some talk of taking a chicken and switching genes on and off to try and get something more like raptor-like. To me, that's kind of silly because birds are already dinosaurs, so you're not turning it into a dinosaur, it already is one.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Jurassic Park, in that sense, won't be a reality, but, you know, at least we have the movies where they bring the dinosaurs to life that way.
Right. Yeah, that's what CGI is for.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, I think we have time for one more. So, without an editor, how does a novice go about writing blogs?
So, if you think about blogs like a blank sheet of paper, basically you can do almost anything you want. You can turn it into a photo journal. You can write a journalistic article. You could write something that's much more personal. But blogs are great for practice, that it's the same thing as, you know, if you're writing something down in a notebook or in a composition leaflet or something like that. The main aspect now to get more people to see it is you really have to engage on social media with other people in the same field. And even, you know, send me like a ping and say like, hey, I wrote this blog post about this dinosaur I really love. Would you mind sharing it? Because now we're like, it used to be that blogs were social media in and of itself. And we have blog roles and comment sections and we all knew each other. And now it's much more dispersed. So that would be my advice is if you want to start getting into science writing by blogging. There's not a direct route anymore. It's a great way to practice. But once you've made your post or made your blog, reaching out to other people and asking if they'd be willing to share them.
Awesome. Okay. So we try to keep these to 45 minutes and we have the like two set questions that we ask everybody at the end. And so the first question is, what is something that you wish everybody knew about your field of expertise, like your area of expertise? And then the second question is what is something that you wish everybody in the world knew about literally anything? It can be as small and insignificant or like big and important as you'd like.
I would say about paleontology, I would like everybody to know that it really is open to everybody. Like, yes, a lot of the science that I write about and that is generated is by professors and curators and people with access to, you know, x-ray scanners and all that sort of thing. But we really need the folks who just get their boots on the ground and have a passion for this and love looking for dinosaurs. Like, paleontology would not exist without the help of community scientists and volunteers and stuff. So really, like, and that's the story that I think needs to be told more often, is that paleontology is really built by enthusiastic amateurs over time. The interpretation often comes from professional scientists, but that there's a much broader community that we should highlight. And just one fact in general that I wish that everybody knew, I think it's really cool. So this is part of what I wrote about in Skeleton Keys, is that we think of our bones as static most of the time. Like, and we know this is not the case because we're very different when we're born versus when we grow up and think of that. But we often tend to think of bones as like dead tissue. Yeah. But they're very much alive as much as any other part of your body is. That there are specific cells that are constantly breaking, even as we sit here now, they're breaking down our bones and eating the old bone tissue, while other ones are splitting out new bone tissue. And your bones like turn over, like some of our bones, like our rib bones, like about every 10 years, it basically replaces itself. And that's why skeletons change over time. So that would be the one view that I'd like people to take, that big sort of concept, is that, you know, your bones are just alive as your muscles or your skins or any other organ tissue is. And it really records a history of who you are. So if you have a minute at some point to sit and think about your skeleton for a minute, it's kind of a weird experience, but I really recommend
that. Sounds good. That's awesome. Okay, cool. Last thing, where can we find you on social media?
So you can find me on Twitter and on Instagram at Laylaps, and that's spelled L-A-E-L-A-P-S. You can also go to rileyblack.net, and that will have a listing of, you know, some of my articles and books, and those are the main places to go find me.
Great. Is there anything else you'd like to plug before we wrap up?
I don't think so. Thank you so much for this. This has been so much fun.
This has been really fun. Thank you so much for joining us. So this was great. And Aaron, thank you for signing for us. We're always so glad that you're here. Let's see. It's Friday. So Monday, 1 p.m., we're going to be talking about hagfish slime. Tuesday, we're going to be talking about vocal learning in parrots. Oh, cool. And then Friday, we're going to be talking about disaster drones. So join us next week. I hope you all have a restful weekend and are ready next week to keep tackling everything we need to. So have a great weekend. Thank you again, Riley, for joining us. And thank you, Aaron, for signing. We'll see y'all later.
Thank you both. Bye.
Bye.